This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Well, America, for at least one fleeting moment, democracy is safe, or at least safer than it was before the midterm elections. And so maybe we all deserve a little break, a diversion. Now, I'm not a particularly knowledgeable fan of the beautiful game. The NBA is more my thing. But every 4 years, I get deep into the World Cup, a global phenomenon that this year will be played out in the tiny Middle Eastern nation of Qatar. And in my city, New York, anticipation is running high.
Who are you rooting for?
Ecuador, of course. We're the ones that play first.
Yeah, I think it's the Senegal, yeah.
Argentina, Brazil.
Either Iran or England.
Wales in the World Cup.
USA, baby!
The best team win the World Cup.
I like football because the energy.
We was born on soccer. Like,
you need a piece of land, a ball, and that's it, bunch of guys. That's all you need.
I've been waiting my whole life for us to get there.
It hasn't happened since 1958, so it's been 64 years.
Even if I'm in school, I'm going to watch the game. So.
How are you going to do that?
Nah, I got something on the app that I can watch the game on loud.
We actually have the big screen ready.
I already bet for Senegal to reach at least a quarterfinal.
It's amazing. It's fabulous. I'm very proud. Big claps from New York, definitely.
Iran, Iran.
Vamos con todo.
Viva Senegal.
The best team in Africa.
Come on, Camry. I'm all here.
Go Ecuador.
Si se puede, which means that yes, we can.
What a bet. Is Senegal going to win the World Cup? Yes. I'm positive. I dreamed last night.
Some people say it's a beautiful game. Do you know why they say that?
Because it is.
Soccer fans from around the world interviewed in New York. But for all the anticipation, this year's World Cup is taking place under an immense cloud of scandal. We've seen headlines about the death of migrant workers who built the facilities. Charges of wire fraud, racketeering, and money laundering have led to arrests and indictments around the world. Even Sepp Blatter, the former president of FIFA and a very dicey figure in the drama, even he said that Qatar hosting the World Cup was a mistake. That's a quote. The choice was bad, he said. No kidding. Blatter is banned from the game after an ethics probe, though he continues to deny any wrongdoing. Heidi Blake, who recently joined The New Yorker, is an investigative journalist who dug into what happened at FIFA along with a colleague, Jonathan Calvert, when they were both reporting for a British newspaper. They ultimately collaborated on a book about how Qatar was awarded the World Cup, and it's called The Ugly Game. Here's Heidi Blake.
I have to confess that I am not a football fan. I don't follow the sport. I couldn't explain the offside rule to you if I tried, which is deeply embarrassing, but did mean that I came to this kind of as a bit of an innocent.
Let's start with this. Why is it important to any country to get the World Cup? What does it mean for a country?
What sort of became clear to me as I went about the reporting was just how deeply enmeshed world football and, you know, and global sports more broadly, but I think particularly football, have become with geopolitics. It's hard to overstate how glitzy a prize it is for any individual bidding country to win the rights to host the World Cup.
The Emir of Qatar has led his country from a small pearling industry to one of the richest in the world, with oil and gas. It had been his idea to bid for the World Cup, and they carried him aloft as they took to their cars.
The Qatar World Cup is expected to be watched by 5 billion people. There's literally no other event which would attract the world's gaze to your country to that extent, particularly for countries that are trying to position themselves in the world as major global players, you know, as kind of up and coming forces in the modern world, like Qatar. This is a huge prize.
Qatar wants to do what? What does it hope to achieve specifically to Qatar by having the World Cup? And they've spent a hell of a lot of resources and effort to get it.
They sure have $300 billion on infrastructure alone to pull this thing off. I mean, it's eye-watering. For Qatar, the bid to host the World Cup was part of the Emir's plan to diversify the Qatari economy and Qatar's position in the world for the future when their oil and gas reserves begin to dwindle. This is a hugely key part of that plan.
So let's go back to 2014. I think that's where we're positioning this. Can you recall what happened when you learned, and you were a journalist at the Sunday Times at the time, when you learned that a whistleblower from inside FIFA, the most powerful international soccer organization, had come forward with evidence of corruption within FIFA as it pertained to the bidding for the 2022 World Cup? What was going on?
Well, I work for the Sunday Times Insight team, an investigations team sort of embedded at the heart of the newspaper. And the Insight team had a bit of a history of reporting on corruption within FIFA and in particular in the World Cup bidding process. My then colleague, Jonathan Calvert, in 2010, while the World Cup bid was going on, had learned of allegations of corruption and had actually gone undercover and approached FIFA voters, asking them what would it take to win their support for the World Cup.
So they put a price tag on it, a specific price tag.
A specific price tag. It was very clear that, you know, the exact sums these people were looking for. And, you know, we were then approached years later by this source who came forward from inside world football and said to us that they had obtained an enormous cache of documents. There were literally hundreds of millions of emails and bank transfer slips and chat logs and phone records. I mean, it was a kind of absolute treasure trove, which, you know, showed in really eye-popping detail the way that Qatar had gone about paying bribes on an industrial scale across the world football community to buy up support for the tournament.
FIFA chief Sepp Blatter is in Zimbabwe and has promised to crack down on match fixing in football. During his two-day visit, he appeared to take a tough stance against anyone found guilty of corruption.
You kind of sequestered yourself, as I understand it, for about 3 months in a kind of bunker-style setting. Can you describe that and what it was like to work that concertedly and that secretively for 3 months?
I mean, it was really wild. The source was understandably very, very nervous about their safety and the ramifications for them of having blown the whistle on this kind of a scale. I mean, this was one of the very, very first huge data leaks, actually, back in 2014. And they were very concerned. So the terms on which they were prepared to allow us to look at the documents was that we had to relocate to this, you know, what we came to affectionately call the bunker, this kind of dingy office space in a remote outpost of the UK, where we were not to be sort of in regular contact with colleagues or friends or family. We were monitored by CCTV. Our keystrokes on our computers were monitored, all to make sure we didn't try to remove any of the documents we were viewing. And so it was kind of a bit of a pressure cooker environment being in there. And we had 3 months before the World Cup kicked off in Brazil. And so we knew that we wanted to drop the story ahead of the tournament because that was going to be when there was just maximum attention. The whole world would be watching FIFA at that point. You know, the clock was ticking and we worked sort of crazy hours and just sort of made our eyeballs bleed reading these documents at sort of 3 in the morning.
I'm interested first in FIFA itself, which operates a billion-dollar nonprofit. How it went from being almost like a gentleman's club founded in 1904 with less than, I think, a dozen employees, to what you call a global powerhouse with billions of dollars in revenue and hundreds of staff members. Just give us a brief history lesson on FIFA.
Well, yeah, it's an extraordinary story, and it's really a quirk of Swiss association law that allows FIFA, an organization which commands revenues of billions of dollars each World Cup cycle in TV rights and sponsorship deals, to call itself a non-profit organization. But yeah, FIFA really wasn't professionalized until the kind of 80s and 90s under Sepp Blatter's predecessor, the former FIFA president, Hal Havelange, who begun to see the potential to exploit the rights to show the World Cup on TV, sponsorship deals. But it was actually Blatter who came in as Havelange's protege in 1998 and really professionalized FIFA, really saw the opportunity to start selling those deals, and took what was a fairly small entity to these global heights, where now FIFA executives are greeted around the world like heads of state. You know, Sepp Blatter would travel the world and be welcomed by prime ministers and presidents, kings and queens. And I think that's because of the political significance that the rights to host the World Cup have come to accrue.
So much of your book, The Ugly Game, focuses on someone named Mohammed bin Hammam. Who is he?
So Mohammed bin Hammam was, until 2011, the most senior football official in Qatar. He was a member of FIFA's executive committee, which was the then 24-person committee who have the ability to select the next host of the World Cup. And the World Cup is really the jewel in the crown for FIFA. And so a place on that committee is the most coveted position in world football.
24 executive committee members are appointed by worldwide football confederations and associations, and they in turn elect a president. Collectively, they determine the movement of billions of dollars coming in from TV and sponsorship deals. And the awarding of World Cups is determined by them. Until a few years ago,
bin Hammam had ascended sort of through the ranks of Qatari society. He is a construction magnate in Qatar. He made his billions in the construction boom after Qatar's discovery of oil and natural gas. And he then, you know, he was a football fan and managed to get himself by hook or by crook onto the FIFA executive committee, and then found himself in this extraordinary position of being tasked by the Emir of Qatar with bringing the rights to host the World Cup to Doha. And, you know, bin Hammam was the first to say, this is impossible, this can never be achieved, for all kinds of reasons. But he was a loyal patriot, and he set about trying to do it.
What was the task in front of him? What were the obstacles for Qatar to get the World Cup as opposed to any other country?
Well, Qatar is almost sort of uniquely badly positioned to host the World Cup. That's kind of why the dam broke at that point on FIFA corruption, because people looked at this and thought, there is no logical explanation for that decision. This process must have been corrupted. And that's because Qatar is a tiny country. The Qatari citizenry amount to about 300,000 people. Everybody else in Qatar is a migrant worker or a foreigner who's moved there and doesn't have citizenship. The total population is about 2.9 million at the moment. There are 1.5 million football fans who descend on a country hosting the World Cup. So if you imagine trying to cram another 1.5 million people into a country of 2.9 million, I mean, it sort of just doesn't make sense. Qatar had no existing infrastructure in place for a tournament on this scale. The city in which the World Cup was scheduled to be hosted, Lusail, did not exist at the point at which Qatar was awarded the rights. They had to build a city north of Doha. They had to build 7 air-conditioned stadiums in the desert. They've spent
We need to dwell on that. 7 air-conditioned stadiums.
Yeah, in the desert. I mean, they had to move the tournament to winter because the temperatures in Qatar are so punishing in the summer when the tournament is normally played. But yeah, the only way that this would work was to air condition the stadiums in the desert heat.
So when they win, people have to say, there's no way that palms weren't greased on a global scale.
That's right. There are just kind of countless reasons why this obviously was a terrible idea. And so at the point at which it was announced, I think that was when it was a bridge too far.
So then what did the documents tell you? Whose palms were being greased, on what scale, who was guilty of what?
Well, what was interesting about the documents was that, you know, we knew that Mohammed bin Hammam was the most senior figure in Qatari football, and he was widely believed to be the mastermind of the campaign to host the World Cup. But Qatar's official bid committee had always sought to distance themselves from him. And what we could see in the documents was that they had been using him as a kind of cutout. So while they themselves ran a fairly straightforward bid that did toe the line of the FIFA rules, Mohammed bin Hammam was flying around the world, hosting football officials on junkets where he handed out wads of cash, and did, you know, held private meetings with football officials where he would say to them, I'd like you to support the World Cup, and then would bung them a huge amount of cash. And what was extraordinary about this for us as journalists investigating this kind of thing is, you know, this kind of thing, people are normally careful enough not to leave a paper trail. But in this case, Mohammed bin Hammam had a very punctilious assistant who kept meticulous records. And so every time Mohammed bin Hammam paid one of these bribes, Najib would email a copy of the bank transfer slip to the official concerned, saying, please find attached for your records. And, you know, and Mohammed bin Hammam thanks you for your support for the Qatar 2022 World Cup. And so, I mean, I've never seen graft and corruption documented in this kind of detail ever before.
So from a repertorial point of view, this giant cache of dispositive evidence, not for want of trying, I'm sure, but fell into your laps. And what it took most of all was the patience to sift through it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it really was 3 months of sitting and trawling through the documents. We used forensic search software, often used by law enforcement in cases like these, to kind of piece together the evidence. And we were triangulating documents, like we had sort of internal messenger logs from the organizations we were looking at. So we could see members of staff kind of gossiping about things. We could see emails. We could see flight manifests. We could see accounts documents. We could see bank transfers. So we spent 3 months building an enormous timeline of all of the documents we could see. We kind of mapped out a network of slush funds that bin Hammam was using, including his daughter's bank account and then the accounts of the Asian Football Confederation that he controlled, to route these payments to football officials. And just to find that kind of long trail of documented bribes was one of the more thrilling moments for me as a journalist, because it's so rare to see bribery and corruption documented like that. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Unbelievable. The first matches of the World Cup are about to begin in Qatar very, very soon. How is it possible, after what you uncovered, how is it possible that they held on to the World Cup?
Well, I mean, that is the $6.5 billion question, I think, that's being the projected revenues for this World Cup. It's extraordinary and it's very depressing, actually. You know, the way that FIFA responded when we published our evidence was to deny that there was any evidence. And actually, you know, at the time, I remember being very shocked by the sort of cognitive dissonance of dealing with an organization where we had published all this evidence and they were saying the evidence doesn't exist, there is no evidence. Now, I think in 2022, we're a little more used to dealing with powerful organizations and individuals who just deny the truth and, kind of muddy the waters in that way. But it was unusual. And even now, that 17 of the 22 FIFA executive committee members who were in place at the time Qatar was awarded the cup have now been arrested or indicted or charged or accused of corruption and bribery. This is not just a journalistic inquiry. This is, you know, established fact.
What became of Mohammed bin Hammam?
Well, that is a kind of extraordinary coda to this whole story. He did this for his country, and he's now been cast out of the royal circle. The Qatari royal family and Sepp Blatter did a deal whereby it was agreed that he would go quietly, take the rap, and never appear again in relation to football or to the World Cup. And so he now lives in Doha, but he doesn't appear publicly. And meanwhile, you know, the Qatari royals and the Supreme Committee who are organising the World Cup are kind of reaping those rewards and having their huge victory lap. And Bin Hammam has been totally cast aside.
Now, these matches are going to begin. Who cares? In other words, do the fans show any, you know, disaffection, disappointment, skepticism in the aftermath of your pieces and then the book?
You know, I think that what people actually care about now is not so much the bribes and the corruption, but is the human cost of that corrupt decision. You know, and for me, this is an object lesson in why corruption matters, because it results in terrible decisions that have real impact on the lives of people. You know, it's not just about cash in brown envelopes. It's about migrant workers who've died building stadiums in the desert. And it's about LGBTQ fans who are going to go to the World Cup and feel unsafe because they've been told not to make public displays of affection because homosexuality is a crime in Qatar. It's a place where journalists have been detained for trying to report on the abuse of migrant workers and on World Cup corruption. So fans are showing showing outrage at that, but nonetheless, the tournament is happening and Qatar got its way, and it's a real shame that, you know, such a blatantly corrupted decision was not reversed.
Heidi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Heidi Blake is a contributing writer at The New Yorker, and she wrote and published The Ugly Game along with Jonathan Calvert. Now, a couple of things we need to note here. FIFA later denied that there was any sort of deal between and among Bin Hammam, Sepp Blatter, and Qatar's royal family. And Qatar has denied that Bin Hammam was tasked with promoting the nation's bid in an official or unofficial capacity. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Last week, the state of Nevada re-elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate. That was a decisive moment. Catherine Cortez Masto's win gave the Democrats their 50th seat in the Senate. The runoff in Georgia next month will surely be dramatic, but the deal was sealed in Nevada. Our contributor, Stefania Telladreed, covered the race from Las Vegas. And early on the morning of Election Day, she was at a rally held by the Culinary Workers Union. Catherine Cortez Masto addressed the crowd.
Good morning. Buenos días a todos. Let me just say, this is so exciting to be with all of you. Are we ready to win?
Yeah!
You know how we win?
So the mood in the room was ecstatic. But at the national level, many people actually thought that Senator Cortez Masto was at risk of losing this election. And beyond that, that Republicans would make significant gains among Latino voters. What happened instead, as you know, is a more complicated story.
Stefania has been covering Latino politics for The New Yorker, not only in Nevada, but in Texas, Florida, and elsewhere in the country.
To better understand what happened here, I wanted to talk with Chuck Rocha and Mike Madrid. They host a podcast that I listen to called The Latino Vote. They're both political consultants on opposite sides of the aisle. Chuck was a senior advisor to Bernie Sanders. Mike was a founding member of the Lincoln Project. And it's just been so refreshing for me listening to their podcast to hear two veteran political analysts having a really nuanced and honest conversation about the state of the Latino vote.
What do you make of the narrative
that Latinos are increasingly turning to the Republican Party.
Go ahead, Mike. That's right on a tee for you right there. Don't try to pull your shoulder.
I've been waiting to jump in.
Don't pull your shoulder when you get this now. Easy.
Okay. So, yeah. So, it's important to understand that in many ways, the Hispanic shift rightward happened in 2020.
Hmm.
David Shore, I think one of the more prominent data scientists in the Democratic Party, put this really well. The realignment basically already happened. The new baseline for Hispanic support in the Republican Party is now sitting at 37, 38, 39%, the high 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It is huge. And if you had told me that 6 years ago, I would have said that's crazy.
Mm.
So it is huge. The shift happened, and we can debate whether it went down to 36 or up to 39. But the way to look at this is to understand that realignments occur over decades, right? When the Republican Party sought to realign the South with the Southern strategy, that began in the late 60s, 1970 campaign, and it didn't really manifest itself until 1994.
Hmm.
That's 25 years, and that's essentially what I think the story of the Latino community is going to be, is it's a generational change. We're not seeing, for example, big registration numbers for Republicans. The registration numbers with Latinos are staying the same for Democrats. But when you look at the precincts in the Rio Grande Valley, if you look at the precincts in southern New Mexico, if you look at the precincts in Colorado, if you look at the performance in Nevada and in Arizona, and even in California this year, there is a discernible rightward shift with the raw data, meaning it happened. We can argue about how big or how little, but the simple fact is if you look at the narrative, especially over time, it's undeniable that it's happening.
Mm-hmm. The one place where we have a pretty clear picture of what has happened with Latinos is Florida. Some people talk about Florida as an exception, but, you know, we saw that Miami-Dade, a historically blue county, went Republican for the first time in years. Mike, I want to start with you. You've made the case that Florida is increasingly isolated from the rest of the country. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not only isolated demographically in the combination of the pillars of the Republican Party that constitute the GOP is different than what you see from some of the more broader states in the union. You also have an extraordinarily different construct of Latino voters, as you mentioned. Cubans and Puerto Ricans tends to dominate the voter model there. It's one of the few states where Mexican Americans are not the majority, certainly the overwhelming majority of the Latino voters there. But it is undeniable that Ron DeSantis did significantly overperform. And when I say significantly, I mean by significantly.
Right.
So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is unique? What is different? We know the Cuban story. We know the Venezuelan story, but what we're seeing with Puerto Ricans who have traditionally broken more Democrat is this consolidation under the GOP banner as well, and Mexican Americans, most surprisingly, breaking towards the Republican Party. I don't think I've ever seen, except for maybe New Mexico back in the 80s, Republicans win the Mexican American vote. I think a lot of it has to do with the construct of the service economy that we have in Florida, the push for DeSantis to open the economy and keep these workers employed. But it does stand as a unique outlier in terms of not just the Latino vote, but obviously with this huge red wave, a state that does not look like the rest of the country at this moment in time.
Chuck, how do you expect Democrats to respond to the trends that we're seeing in Florida? Certainly when I was reporting about the 2020 election from Miami, the message that I got from voters and even from some campaign operatives was that the party wasn't investing nearly enough as it should in the community there. Do you think this is giving them any reason to revert course? What can we expect to see?
I wish that we would go down and compete, because Barack Obama taught us that if you show up with the right message, you can get the majority of Cubans, even if it's small, to vote for you. Of course, he was transformational, and all you people on Twitter, I get it. You're right. Once in a lifetime, blah, blah, blah. But if you just walk away, National Democrats, and you're just like, that's an outlier. They'll be red. It's a red state forever. That starts bleeding into Georgia. That starts bleeding into little other places that we are already underinvesting in year round for long-term bilingual organizing.
And Chuck, I want us to briefly focus on Pennsylvania, where there are a lot more Latinos than people recognize. and most of them were Puerto Rican. Tell us about the work that you did for John Fetterman's campaign there.
I wasn't working directly for the Fetterman campaign, but instead the largest Senate super PAC in America that spent the most money, I'm proud to say this, on bilingual advertising than any single operation in America. That means all the other congressional campaigns and Senate campaigns combined. This super PAC invested starting 6 months out in most of these elections and not just doing Spanish TV, but doing radio, doing mail, doing newspaper ads, and had a field team on the ground in each one of these states knocking on doors. Mike talks about a new baseline. He'll continue to talk about a new baseline. Is it 34? Is it 36? Is it 42, for God's sakes? What we know and what I know in Pennsylvania is when you spend a lot of time and effort showing up in a culturally competent way, you can get that number back to the 70-30 number, because that's what we did. And that's not an exit poll. That's a daily tracker in Spanish in a concentrated area where all the Latinos only live in about 35 precincts. So we showed up on the radio. We showed up in their mailboxes. We showed up at their doors, but we did it more than just the last 2 weeks of GOTV. That is key. And then you take the importance of having me and white folks around me who agreed with me that when the Philadelphia Phillies made it to the United States World Series, how'd you catch that, Madrid? On the World Series, that we bought the Spanish language simulcast, because guess what Puerto Ricans really love? They love baseball, and they have a history of baseball. So these little things don't make all the difference, but it means that you have a better chance of getting more people to show up that are Latino, Latino voters. And me and Mike talked about this, and I know I've already talked too much, but also you should know that the Republicans were not competing against me in Spanish in those markets, which also helps a lot.
And talking about margins, you both know all too well that this is a game of margins, right? They appear to be getting tighter and tighter. But at the same time, what we saw in places like Texas is that many Latinos cast a vote against extremism. Mike, would it be fair to say that theirs was a vote for moderation?
I think that's absolutely one of the findings that we're going to see. If you look at precincts like Tim Ryan's in Ohio, what you saw was these dramatic shifts away from these Trumpy positions in the most Hispanic precincts in Ohio towards Tim Ryan, like a 20-point swing. It's hard to draw any other conclusions than the moderates candidates that are positioning for as working class candidates on working class issues in the Democratic Party are doing significantly better than those that are leaning into this culturally leftward narrative that is seeing performance drop. And this is an important way to look at the vote. You've got a lot of, especially Latino Democratic members of Congress, making a really big mistake, saying we've got more Latino Democrats in Congress. How can we have lost the Latino vote or not improved? And the answer is very simple, math. The way that works is the margins in most of these districts are tightening, and not small, they're tightening considerably. And so a lot of these candidates in the Democratic caucus, I think, are making the mistake of leaning to the left when moderation is where Hispanics are responding. It's showing up in Ohio. It's showing up in the Rio Grande Valley. It's showing up in Los Angeles County. It's showing up in Miami South Dade. To me, it's pretty incontrovertible evidence.
And I guess Nevada is also an example of that, right? I mean, the results that we saw during the Senate race.
Nevada is a perfect example of that. And I would even argue even Arizona is an example of that. But Nevada especially, look, when the dust settles and we start getting the precinct data in, Senator Cortez Masto, who's also the first Latina in the U.S. Senate, will probably win by a smaller margin than she won by 6 years ago. Right. And her Latino numbers will probably come in exactly what they were 6 years ago, which you know, people saying that you know, Latinos helped improve the vote for the Senate. It's really hard to make that case. And I'm a huge advocate. I've spent my entire career of turning voters out and registering Latinos all over the country. But I'm also a believer in math. You have to look at yourself honestly to get a really good assessment of where the community is at. The Latino vote probably went down a little bit in 2022, and most of the evidence suggests that it stayed from a partisan split, if not exactly where it was in the 2020 race, that it moved a little bit even further to the right.
Chuck, do you share that view about Nevada?
Of course I don't. That's what makes me and Mike Madrid so great. You should listen to our podcast. Absolutely. Mike does make some good points, but I'd also caution folks, and what Mike is saying is true, but you also, for those of you looking at people on Twitter and people pontificating about this election, Catherine Cortez Masto's got elected in a presidential year. I'll tell you something about Latino voters that Mike Madrid can't argue with, is that more of us show up in a presidential year. There's one thing on Tuesday night that born true. That is, we elected Monica De La Cruz, a MAGA Latina Republican in the Valley, and elected on the other side Maxwell Alejandro Frost from the far left side of the party in Orlando. They both represent each end of the Latino electorate, and then we make up all the different sectors in between.
You've both dedicated your careers to raising awareness about Latino voters and making sure that political campaigns take our community's voices into considerations. I wonder, in 2020, if you can speak to what's changed since you started working in politics. Is there more diversity? Are people finally getting the message? And are they pouring enough money into the community? Chuck?
Oh, man, you wanted me to scratch that itch. Whew. So let me say this, that me and Mike Madrid bring over 60 years of campaign experience. And we probably have more experience than the top Latino operatives in the country now, because there's probably like maybe three other ones. That's a problem. It's embarrassing. And in the most marginal congressional and Senate races in America, there was not one Latino campaign manager. There was not a single, there was not a single Latino majority on media and messaging firm working for a single race when 15 of these races were over 20% Latino population. That shows you we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what's your take?
You know, I've had the unique experience of working at the top level of campaigns in this country on both sides of the aisle. It's very, very rare. You know, and what I remember most successfully with Republican campaigns was the George W. Bush campaigns. Hmm. It was a seamless operation from top to bottom, kind of what Bernie Sanders replicated in 2016
right.
is what George W. Bush did. And that was when you saw Republicans the most successful. Bush getting 37% in 2000 and 44% in 2004. What surprised me the most in working with the Democratic Party was how calcified it really was and the lack of diversity at the top of the Democratic Party. Like, it's more white probably than the Republican Party, which may sound peculiar, but I can go back historically and say in the Republican Party, there's always been Alex Castellanos. There's always been Lionel Sosa. There's always been the Frank Guerras of the world. And the Democratic Party, I'm kind of like Sergio Bendixson, you know, maybe from you know, the Carter administration. And that's kind of it when you look back. When Chuck makes the point that there are no Latino campaign operatives in the Democratic Party that were running in any of these, you know, very diverse districts, that does not surprise me at all. And there's the problem. This is not, I'm not being critical of either party. I'm being critical of both parties. We can't just resort to using Google Translate for commercials in English and expect that they're going to work in Spanish. And that's still happening. We can't expect people to have this hierarchical white system on both sides of the aisle and expect Latino voters to show up in higher numbers when they're not seeing themselves reflected in campaigns, when they're not hearing messages tailored to their voices and to their communities and to their experience. And it's something that I think needs to be reconciled and very quickly, not for partisan purposes, but for the health of our democracy purposes.
And do you worry now that the narrative that we're hearing coming out of the midterms is that Democrats exceeded everyone's expectations, that the party might take for granted the Latino vote as they have in the past?
Look, the same people that are denying that this shift has happened were the same Latino, you know, professional political operatives in the Democratic Party that denied the losses in 2014, that denied Hillary Clinton's weaknesses in 2016, that denied Donald Trump's movement in 2020. It's the same people doing the same thing. Do I think the Democratic Party is going to make an adjustment? No, I do not. Do I think that there will continue to be a gradual movement to the right? Yes, I think it will be very marginal. And I don't think it's
because Republicans are doing anything right. I think it's because of simple demographics. Republicans are getting a larger incremental share of the Latino vote despite themselves, not because of themselves. The Democratic Party could absolutely make the adjustments to stop it, but they didn't do it in 2014. They didn't do it in 2016. They didn't do it in 2020. They didn't do it in 2022. There's no evidence to suggest that they're going to make that adjustment because too many of them are vested in the system as it exists, and I don't see them making that play.
And I think that the big change is, and I'd push back on Mike on one piece of this, there were groups that were doing good work that made up for a lot of the campaign shortcoming, or we would not have a senator in Arizona, Pennsylvania, or Nevada, because the Senate Majority PAC and other partners hired Latino consultants. I'm one of them, but there were at least six other Latino-owned firms that work for these organizations to go out and reach the community, to hire canvassing crews on the ground. What worries me the most about us having such a, and it, I can't say this enough, historic night, is that Democrats look around at each other and be like, man, we did good. We got this all figured out now. Y'all just go back to your corners. Let's just keep on doing what we've been doing because now we got this stuff figured out. When I'm here to tell you, friends, once we get through the data, not that we did bad, but that we probably didn't do as good as you may be hearing we did, and there's still a lot of work to do because there's one thing beyond a shadow of a doubt on the work I've done all weekend looking at these numbers is that in Latino districts where there was a Senate campaign spending millions of dollars in Spanish, those CDs overperform compared to CDs where that investment never happened.
Looking ahead to 2024, what are some of the trends that you're paying close attention to? And does the roadmap to victory look any different than it did in 2020? Mike?
I think that's a great question. I was very intricately involved with the 2020 presidential campaign and with the Lincoln Project. I've sat in that seat and had to make those calls on those spending decisions. And I will tell you that the map to 270 in 2024 is going to look very different than it did in 2020. Florida is a Republican state. It is not a swing state. Ohio is a Republican state. It is not a swing state. The battlegrounds of Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin are very, very tight, and they are not secure enough to ensure a Democratic win. The Democrats are going to have to look to broaden their base. North Carolina becomes central. Incidentally, the Latino vote will probably be one of the deciding votes in North Carolina in 2024. Let me say that again. The Hispanic vote will probably be decisive in a state like North Carolina. That's pretty deep. That tells you how deep this is into the fabric of America at this point. So this shift, this demographic shift, and the margins with which Democrats are winning as they get smaller are changing the calculus for the way a president finds that 270 magic number to be elected president of the United States. That's not going to change. That is going to change every year into a direction where more and more states are likely to come into play. And I think both campaigns are important. It's important that both campaigns make that adjustment.
Chuck?
I think that it's going to come down to six states in 2024 again. And I guess what? To Mike's point, our community has big populations in all of them. It starts with what we call the blue wall. Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania have an emerging great Latino population. A couple facts for you. 300,000 Puerto Ricans have moved to Pennsylvania in the last 10 years. Fact, in Wisconsin, there are more Latinos than there are African Americans. And in Michigan, I ran a statewide Spanish language operation in the off year this year, and you would be amazed at the number of second generation explosion of all these Mexicans, mainly from Texas, that moved to work in the auto industries in the 70s and 80s, and now all their sons and daughters have sons and daughters, and it's an explosion. And then the ones that you know, which is Georgia, where there's over a million Latinos that live in Georgia, and then Arizona and Nevada, right back to where we started.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so, so much for your time and your insights. It's been wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you.
It was a great conversation.
Political consultant Chuck Rocha, and we also heard from Mike Madrid. They both appear on the podcast The Latino Vote, and they spoke with The New Yorker's Stefania Telladreed. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Not too long ago, we started publishing a new column on NewYorker.com called Afterword. It's written by the great Susan Orlean, and Afterword is an obituary column of sorts. But instead of focusing on the lives of the highly newsworthy, Susan writes about people and animals and even things that never made it to the front page. As we near the end of the year, we'll be taking note of some of those lives here at the New Yorker Radio Hour. So here's Susan Orlean reading from her piece, The Ultimate Tiger Mom.
Unlike most tiger mothers, Collar Wally was, in fact, a tiger. Her life was characterized by unusualness. She was unusually large for a female, so big observers often mistook her for a male, and other tigers were scared to fight with her. She was unusually friendly. Tigers are solitary and shy, but Collar Wally seemed relaxed about venturing near people and was often spotted afoot in the Pench Tiger Reserve in Madhya Pradesh in India, where she lived. Most notably, she was unusually fertile. She gave birth to 29 cubs in her lifetime, which accounts for almost 1% of all the tigers in India. She was also unusually well-known. Her mother, Badi Mata, was the subject of the popular BBC documentary Tiger, Spy in the Jungle from 2008.
Tigers are generally said to succeed just one time out of 10, but this tigress kills on average every third try.
With narration by David Attenborough, the documentary followed the life of Badi Mata and her litter of four cubs, one of which was Collar Wally.
Even at this size, each cub consumes around 2 kilos of meat at a single sitting.
After this celebrated start, Collar Wally lived an unusually long time. The average tiger lifespan is 15 years, which she bettered by almost 2. When she died in January, she lay in state on a flower-strewn pyre, and her funeral was attended by a crowd including Madhya Pradesh's forest minister and a number of other government officials. Mourning was widespread. Collar Wally was formally known, less poetically, as T-15. In 2008, she was the first tigress in Pench to be fitted with a radio collar, hence her nickname Collar Wally, which means collar wearer in Hindi. That same year, Collar Wally gave birth to her first litter, but she fumbled as a new mother and all her cubs died of pneumonia. In time, though, she developed serious motherhood skills, and her next litters flourished. In 2010, she gave birth to a mega litter of 5 cubs. Tiger litters are usually 3 or 4 in size, and half of all cubs born die in the first years of their lives. To rear a whopping 5 cubs is world class. Collar Wally was a tough love kind of mother, letting her cubs start hunting earlier than a more helicopter parenting sort of tigress. Her methodology was so successful that her cubs not only overachieved, they even stayed in touch with her after they moved away, which is said to be rare in the tiger world. Tigers are India's national animal. And in 1973, a conservation effort called Project Tiger was launched to try to stabilize their declining population. Tigers with wanderlust that leave conservation areas are sometimes killed by farmers, and farmers are sometimes killed by tigers. The market for tiger parts, which are believed to have health benefits, including as aphrodisiacs, continues to flourish. Nevertheless, conservation efforts coupled with Collar Wally's fecundity have made a difference, and India's tiger population is slowly rising. at Kalerwali's funeral following her death from natural causes, social distancing was observed, but the occasion was equally stirring. The enormous tigress was covered with yellow, orange, and white carnations, and she was shrouded in white except for her magnificent head. A line of mourners approached the wooden pyre one by one and offered her flowers before she was cremated. Kalerwali's remarkable fruitfulness did raise the risk of her cubs inbreeding, but on balance, her mothering was a net positive and her loss a tragedy. After the funeral, the chief minister of the state wrote on Twitter, "The forests of Madhya Pradesh will always resonate with the roar of the cubs of the Queen of Pench Tiger Reserve."
Susan Orlean reading from The Ultimate Tiger Mom from April of this year. You can read Susan's column afterward at newyorker.com. And we'll hear more from her on the New Yorker Radio Hour in the coming weeks. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele,
along with Adam Howard, Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.